This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America, analysis of U.S. politics and countdown to the 2018 congressional midterm elections. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Confirmation hearings underway in the Senate for Brett Kavanaugh, U.S. President Donald Trump's pick to replace Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy, come on the heels of a dizzying summer. In August, a federal court jury in Virginia convicted President Trump's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, of 8 counts of fraud. Then, the president's longtime attorney and fixer, Michael Cohen, entered a plea in federal court in New York, admitting he paid hush money during the final days of the 2016 presidential campaign to 2 women who had affairs with Mr. Trump, and that he did so at the candidate's direction. Analysts say this could implicate the president as an unindicted co-conspirator in felony crimes. Besides Mr. Cohen, 3 other men who worked for Mr. Trump also have pled guilty to crimes: former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, former Deputy Campaign Manager Rick Gates, and a campaign foreign policy advisor, George Papadopoulos. The list of people close to President Donald Trump who have recently turned on him keeps growing. In addition, 2 Trump loyalists were granted immunity: National Enquirer publisher David Pecker and Trump Organization CFO Alan Weisselberg, in exchange for potentially damaging information on Mr. Trump. Also in the waning days of August, Senator John McCain, a Republican war hero and 2-time presidential candidate, passed away after a struggle with brain cancer. Tributes poured in from Democratic and Republican lawmakers, veterans, and ordinary citizens from across the country, as well as from global leaders. While 2 former presidents, George W. Bush and Barack Obama, offered moving eulogies at a star-studded memorial ceremony in honor of Senator McCain in Washington, Mr. Trump was excluded from the event. He had repeatedly disparaged Mr. McCain and his legacy. As if that is not enough to ponder and analyze, excerpts from veteran journalist and author Bob Woodward's explosive new book, Fear, Trump in the White House, depict a devastating portrait of President Trump careening toward a nervous breakdown. The administration mounted a vigorous denial to many of the allegations and statements from officials contained in the book. And then the New York Times took the extraordinary measure of publishing an opinion editorial by an unnamed Trump administration official, saying he or she is part of a, quote, quiet resistance working from within to protect the country from the president's worst impulses and, quote, reckless decisions. Well, with us to, as always, discuss the ever-tumultuous U.S. political landscape are our 2 veteran political analysts. John Fortier is a political scientist and director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and that's a think tank here in Washington, and Jim Kessler. He's senior vice president for policy at Third Way. That's a think tank also based in Washington. And both regulars join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Carol.
Thank you.
John Fortier, let's begin with you. Let's start with these hearings for Judge Brett Kavanaugh, President Trump's pick for Supreme Court Justice to replace Justice Kennedy. Talk about why these hearings are very consequential. They are extraordinary because we're in extraordinary times. This is a swing seat. It's a permanent lifetime appointment, of course, but there are other reasons. Talk about why they are controversial, particularly for the Democrats.
Well, our country is divided, our parties are far apart, and our court is closely divided. Sometimes we speak loosely about a Republican and Democratic side of the court, but broadly there has been a conservative majority, a 5-4 majority on the court, with Justice Kennedy, who's now retired, being a swing vote, mostly conservative, but sometimes swinging to the other side. This is a replacement for that seat, and as Republicans are able to make that appointment, if Judge Kavanaugh is confirmed, they will have likely a more solid 5-4 majority. This is controversial in the short term and in the long term. There's been a battle between both parties about process regarding judicial nominations. Most recently, and what Democrats, I think, are most unhappy about is that Justice Scalia, the previous justice who died on the court last term, had died when Barack Obama was president. And there was an opportunity for Barack Obama to appoint someone. He did actually nominate someone, Judge Merrick Garland. But the Republican Senate chose not to take up that nomination and let the seat sit vacant for a while. And Democrats are particularly unhappy that now, with President Trump being in office, that Republicans did fill that seat and then are going to be able to fill now a swing seat on the court. So there's a battle royale, worries about the direction of the court and about past injustices. So this is what Washington is consumed with at this point. I do think he will be confirmed, but it is certainly a strongly controversial time here in this nomination process.
Indeed, a battle royale, Jim Kessler, for a seat that could potentially change the direction of the court for many decades to come should Brett Kavanaugh, who is perceived at least as more conservative than the justice he's replacing, should he be confirmed. Your take on the hearings, why the Democrats in particular are concerned not just about the process but the substance of major issues at stake, such as the scope of executive power, abortion rights, gun safety legislation, and so forth.
Just building off what John said, I think these hearings come down to two words, and it's Merrick Garland. And Merrick Garland, as John pointed out, was the Supreme Court nominee that Obama chose that the Republican Senate refused to hear, and they had more than a year to approve or disapprove that nominee, and they basically just sat on it. Democrats feel that a Supreme Court seat was stolen from them, and that, you know, now they are having to approve Trump's nominees. And the consequences are really large. There are issues having to do with guns and gun rights, also having to do with abortion. It's very possible that we are seeing the end of, you know, in the next few years of Roe v. Wade. That is now a possibility. That was considered sort of implausible in the past, but we may be at the point where abortion will be declared not protected by the Constitution. So there's a lot at stake with this hearing. There is a ton of bad blood on judicial nominations in the Senate right now. It is the Senate's job to approve judges. And, you know, you've got the backdrop of the Merrick Garland situation in which Democrats feel they were robbed.
There's also the question of process, and many of the Democrats said that there are thousands and thousands of missing documents that they think would be pertinent to making a decision with respect to Brett Kavanaugh. So we'll see this play out in the next few days as hearings continue. Let's move on and let's take up the question of the guilty verdict for Paul Manafort, former Trump campaign manager, John Fortey. And I do that because, again, Mr. Trump is central to this as well. And just as with respect to the hearings for Brett Kavanaugh, the shadow of Mr. Trump looms over here, and many people are concerned because he himself is, to some extent, under investigation, or associates of the Trump administration, with respect to Robert Mueller, who's looking into Russia's interference in the U.S. election and potential ties with the Trump campaign. So we have Paul Manafort, who was, of course, convicted later in August. Talk about the significance of that case, as well as former Trump attorney Michael Cohen.
No president would be happy to be under any sort of investigation, and this investigation has moved in a number of ways which he can't be happy with and is certainly hurting the presidency. I think the Paul Manafort indictment is one that people did expect, and I think the Trump administration would say this primarily related to his bad business dealings in an earlier era, having some clients that are associated with the Russians and not reporting on his taxes and other things. And so that's a bad thing, but I think the Trump administration would say it's not really directly implicating the president or the campaign directly. The Michael Cohen allegations, I think, are potentially more damaging to the president. This is, you know, a lawyer who accused of various things relating to paying off women to not speak about their relationship with Donald Trump. At the end of the day, though, I do think that public opinion has not shifted dramatically on this question of the course of this investigation. I think still it is thought by Republicans that this investigation should go on, but the public opinion is hardening on both sides, where Republican voters, Republican members of Congress are saying, this is all maybe bad stuff, but if the purpose of this investigation was really to get at Russian meddling and collusion with the Trump campaign, they don't think we've seen enough. Maybe more will come out, but unless there's a direct connection to that, there is this question that we saw back in the Clinton administration. Is this a prosecutor who's going to find lots of bad things unrelated to core issues, or is it going to, you know, really deal with this core issue? So we'll see what comes out, but I think Republicans are not really convinced that this is going the way that people thought it would at the core issues, and Democrats are convinced that the president has already shown some inklings that there is collusion, and maybe they want to see more, but they see all this bad stuff as sort of indicting Donald Trump's credibility.
Well, let me get Jim Kessler to weigh in on that, because there's this question of flipping. You might want to talk about that and explain to our audience. Because while Paul Manafort's conviction is not directly related to Russia probe per se, he was very close, of course, to Russians and the Kremlin throughout his career in his unsavory dealings. And there's the question of perhaps he could be persuaded to, as we say, flip and to talk more about potential connections between the Trump campaign and Russia in exchange for a lighter sentence.
Right, exactly. So flipping in the American parlance is that you go from being a subject of an investigation or going into facing long prison time, and you say, look, I'm going to admit my guilt and I'm going to spill the beans to implicate others. And this has been tried and true in the American judicial system for decades and decades. Manafort is a target for this. He's likely facing life in prison, and he doesn't look like a guy who's going to do well there.
Not in his, what is yes, that skin code yet?
Yeah, I just don't think the Trace May hair salon is good. They have that in the federal penitentiary that he's going to go to.
Ostrich coat.
They have that in orange.
This is what I would worry about if I were the Trump administration and Donald Trump. The way these prosecutions work is you start with the minnows and you capture them. And then you go for the bigger fish. And in the end, you get the biggest fish. This investigation is not done. And they just got some pretty big fish. Manafort is a very big fish. And Michael Cohen is a very big fish. And they're not done. But I'll tell you what they are done with. They're done with the small fish. So the next time that someone is named in an indictment, it is going to be a person even bigger within the Trump administration. There's one thing that we haven't heard from Republican leaders that needs to be said. Trump has intimated that he could use his pardon power to basically let Manafort off the hook. Michael Cohen has affirmatively said, I am not seeking a pardon. Speaker Paul Ryan, the Republican leader of the House, and Senator Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader of the Senate, they need to say both privately to President Trump and his team and publicly to the American people that a pardon for anyone in the Mueller investigation will mean an immediate steps to remove him from office. President Trump cannot get out of this by gaming the system and pardoning people. And the Republican leaders in Congress, they need to step up and make sure that is known publicly.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are John Fortier, Director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and Jim Kessler, from whom you just heard. He's Senior Vice President for Policy at Third Way. We're discussing the U.S. political landscape in the run-up to the U.S. midterm congressional elections. Here's a shout-out to B. Guga from Sero. That's a historic village in Botswana, from which most of their presidents hail. Fascinating. Well, back to our program and back to you, John Fortier. A quick word about Senator John McCain, who left us prematurely, a terrific human being, senator, war hero, patriot. It seems a bygone era. Can anyone replace his voice in your view?
Well, John McCain is an American hero, was one of the great senators that we've had. I think really filled that role very strongly, and of course was on the national stage as a presidential candidate twice. So he was known widely. Interestingly, I think John McCain has had times in his life where he was often the more attractive to the Democratic Party and to the media because he took some issues that were independent and maybe independent of his party, things like taking on money in politics and sometimes standing up to president, certainly President Trump, but also if you remember President Bush in some ways. So he was a great figure. Now, he's also caught up in the controversy, as many are, with Donald Trump, where on certain issues, in particular the healthcare vote, he crossed Donald Trump. I wouldn't say that McCain was the most resistant to Trump, but certainly on certain issues, he drew lines that were very stark. And this funeral became, I think, a symbol for many in the Republican Party who are unhappy with the direction of Trump in the party, that this was to remind them of that, and that there were great differences. I do think that McCain's troops and people on his side of the aisle and in this fight with Trump over the future of the party is probably more in the minority of the party. Many Republicans are actually pleased with the direction that Donald Trump is taking the party, and in some ways, John McCain's sort of muscular foreign policy, wanting to go out in the world and promote democracy is something that Republican voters have moved away from. And so it's the end of an era, I think, in a number of ways. A great man, but also one who now sits in the middle of a change within the Republican Party.
How do you see that, Jim Kessler? The end of an era, or perhaps the start of some soul searching for Republicans in particular?
His passing is sad. I do think it is an end of an era. We've been seeing lots of ends of an era in the last few years, I think also with the Trump presidency. I had the privilege of working with him briefly on a gun safety issue, on closing the gun show loophole, which is to make it so that people have to use background checks when they buy a gun at a gun show. And that was against the Republican prevailing position at the time. And I sat with him. I said, you need to understand that the National Rifle Association, the strongest lobby in America, perhaps, will hate you forever for doing this. And he just looked at me. He just kind of grinned. He goes, I know. And he just had guts. He had integrity. And there were a lot of issues that I didn't agree with him. But boy, was he indispensable in this town and for this country. And I was privileged to just, on a couple of occasions, be near him and work with him.
Back to you, John Fortey, and let's move on now to the midterm elections. We've talked about them a lot at these microphones, but we're at the countdown phase, and I'd like to get your take on how they're shaping up. We have 23 key seats in the House of Representatives, which, if they are flipped, that is, go from Republican to Democratic, that could give the Democrats control of the House of Representatives, the lower chamber. How do you see the midterm election shaping up for both parties?
Well, as much as Donald Trump's a very different president, there's a lot of turmoil in Washington. I think the fundamentals of this kind of election are not so different than a typical midterm or that we've been seeing in the last few months. You know, Donald Trump is not a popular president. He's doing better than he was last fall, but typically he's in the 42 or 43% job approval range, certainly on the negative side of popularity. On the other hand, certainly his party is pretty united with him, so I think the Republican Party will stick together. But Democrats are extremely motivated, and you see that in elections, special elections. You see that some in the primaries, where occasionally some very progressive candidates have been benefiting from this. But I think that Republicans are likely to lose the House of Representatives. If I had to give a range, I'd say, you know, in the 30 to 35 seat range is a safe range for Democrats to gain enough to win the majority. There is, I think, even more upside potentially for Democrats that we don't exactly know the size of this enthusiasm. It could be bigger than that. The Senate, for more specific reasons of the seats that are available, I think is a harder opportunity for Democrats. If I had a look at my crystal ball, I'd say the Republicans probably are favored to hold the Senate just because their opportunities are there for Republicans to actually take some seats in very Republican districts that Democrats hold. So good chance we'll have divided government coming out of this election. It has a lot of implications. Divided government, not as much gets done, but also Democrats will have a platform if they take the House of Representatives to really ramp up investigations of Donald Trump, some of which are ongoing, but others which may start, and it will be perhaps even more contentious in that respect than it is today.
Turning to you, Jim, for your take once again on the midterm elections and the potential for a so-called blue wave for the Democrats to take over the House of Representatives, based on a number of primaries we've seen lately, how do you see this shaping up?
I think it's shaping up very well for Democrats. I think they have the potential to run the table. I think they will certainly take the House, and they have a chance of taking the Senate. It is a much smaller chance. I want to start with the House. Congressional districts are drawn by politicians, so there's gerrymandering in these districts, and these districts, they tend to advantage Republicans over Democrats. So you have to think of these races as if it's like a football game. Democrats are down a touchdown just from the beginning, the way maps are drawn. So they have to do extraordinarily well to take back the House, but they've nominated the right candidates. Donald Trump, his popularity is low. That's not that much different than Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. The difference is his unpopularity is fervent and at levels that you just rarely see. The people who don't like him just despise him. And then I also think there's a secret voter that is going to really turn this election, and I think it's going to be women over the age of 50. And particularly white women and white married women over the age of 50 have been fairly reliable Republican voters, and they seem to be the voters that are switching and turning off to Trump and Republicans, both because of Trump's behavior, but also some of the issues that have come out, like on the immigration issues, separating children from their parents, some of the healthcare issues. So suburban women, married women could be a real problem for Republicans this time around, where they've generally been a plus in the past.
Turning back to you, John Fortier, one more question on the elections, and that is strategy. How do you see the Republican strategy? Will they double down on some of the key issues on which Trump seems to be popular among the so-called Republican base, whether it's immigration, the tax cut that was recently passed? The economy seems to be doing fairly well. How do you see the strategy for the Republicans since they are on the back foot in a sense?
Well, stepping back, one thing I think we should note is that Donald Trump is actually pretty well connected to the Republican Party. There was some doubt about that when he was elected. Would he be running as kind of an independent? Would the party be with him? Sure, there are voices in Washington and wings of the party which are not that happy with him, but the average Republican voter is. And so you see Donald Trump going to pretty red states, pretty Republican states, and giving his meat and potatoes message. So I do think his typical issues are what he's going to be running on, and he's endorsing people and sort of putting a stamp on it in a pretty aggressive way. Now, like any president who's less popular, there are parts of the country where he's not going to play very well. And how Republicans are going to be able to hold seats in places where he's not doing as well is a challenge for them. And many of them are going to have to run on their own. But the president has been surprisingly active, and active as a Republican in a way that we might not have expected.
Well, he has been active, Jim Kessler, but I need you to comment on something. He's also been particularly volatile with his rhetoric and language. He has talked about the Democrats as if they win, they would, quote, unleash violence. He's been stoking what many analysts would say are unsubstantiated fears to scare people, which I think does trouble many voters across the political lines. How do you see this type of rhetoric, and what will the Democrats do to combat it? And then, of course, your take on the strategy for the Democrats. Will they talk about this so-called culture of corruption, all of these indictments, and many of his cabinet officials who have had to leave their positions for all kinds of scandals?
Yeah, so there is a Republican strategy in this race, and it's based on fear. And it's fear of several things. One is they are really stoking up immigration and the notion that MS-13, these gangs that come from Central America and sanctuary cities, arguing that some Democrats aren't being strong enough on the immigration issue, that basically Democrats are for open borders and for crime. And if you're looking at the ads that are being run, it is really about fear of the other, fear of the immigrant. And look, you see this all across the Western world. That is part of the right-wing populism. And then, of course, there's the fear of what Democrats would do. There would be blood in the streets, as he said, if Democrats took over. But that's one of the things that he's trying to stoke. He is a politician who believes that a divided country is good for him. I think Donald Trump believes what's good for Donald Trump is what's good for the country.
And the Democrats, you think, will take this type of rhetoric and language head on and discuss what some are saying is this culture of hyperbole and even corruption among some of the officials?
So I think Democrats are running less on a national message. They're running a lot more locally. So Democrats are trying to run as a big tent party that is open to a lot of different viewpoints. So I think Democrats are lining up with the right type of candidates and the right type of message to take advantage of a favorable political climate for them.
One last question very quickly back to you, John Fortier. Anything to comment on with respect to the book by Bob Woodward, Fear, Trump in the White House, and then this anonymous opinion editorial that the New York Times controversially ran by an insider who is saying, you know, we're protecting the country from Trump's worst impulses. I mean, what does that say?
Well, I guess one might take these as shocking, but I guess I think the central message of both of those is that the Trump White House is awfully tumultuous within, and of course there's controversy politically in and out. So I don't think those two venues have given us a greater window into the big picture of what's going on in the Trump administration. People who like him, they may put up with the tumult, but you know, I don't think those two, the book and the op-ed, really told us anything that we didn't already have a pretty good sense of.
Jim, last word to you.
Look, I think the title should have been Petrified, because the Trump administration seems petrified right now about all the leakers going on, including the anonymous op-ed. I think there's something that's pretty clear and that I've never seen in any administration, and that is there are very senior people within the White House and within the administration that absolutely despise their boss, President Trump. They just despise him. They don't trust him. They think he's unfit. They think he's unhinged. And some are doing things in their own way to try and temper him. And I do a lot of media, and I do a lot of media on right-wing platforms, and I hear in the waiting room people say the exact same things that I'm reading in this book and in that anonymous op-ed, and then they get on the air and they defend him.
All right, well, on that note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, as always, John Fortier, Director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and Jim Kessler, Senior Vice President for Policy at Third Way. Gentlemen, as always, thanks so much for your terrific insights.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guests. Our engineer was Joe Gill, and I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.